This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Sorry to remind you of winter in the height of our short and sweet summer, but as you know, winters are long and they can be harsh. And here in the North Country, we spread a lot of salt on our roadways to melt the ice that causes hazardous driving conditions. But that salt has to go somewhere, and it runs off the hardtop and eventually into our lakes and rivers. A group of researchers has been taking a look at how that salt is affecting water bodies from Maine to the Midwest. Flora Krivec-Tetley is a PhD student in biology at Dartmouth College and part of the Global Lake Ecological Observatory Network that's been doing this research, and she joins us now to talk about their findings. Flora, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Your group studied 371 lakes in the U.S. and in Canada. So did you see increased salinization in any or many of those bodies of water?
We did. As you mentioned, we looked at the patterns in those 371 lakes, and these were lakes where we could find at least 10 years of samples, so we had 10 years of data. We wanted to look at long-term patterns, and among those lakes in the Midwest and the Northeast, so that's our cold or snowy winter regions, we saw that long-term salinization was pretty common. So in 44% of those lakes, we saw increasing salt concentrations over time.
So 41% of the lakes had increasing concentrations, but were the increasing concentrations significant increases?
Yeah, it's a good question. 26 of those lakes had salt. And when I say salt, I'm talking about chloride ion. So sodium and chloride are the two ions that make up, say, table salt. And the chloride ion is a really good measure of salt. So 26 of those lakes had over 100 milligrams per liter of chloride ion. And as a comparison, so rainwater, let's say, has up to maybe a maximum of 20 milligrams per liter, but often much, much lower than that. And the EPA has a criterion for aquatic life, so a level above which aquatic life can't survive, and that's 230 milligrams per liter. So we did have a couple of lakes that were actually over 230, but we had over 25 that were beyond 100 milligrams per liter, which is a lot higher than we normally see in freshwater bodies.
Now, 25 out of 371 doesn't sound like a lot or perhaps sound like a bad thing, is it?
Fair enough. if you take a look at the trends that are happening in those lakes, while right now this study didn't look at what the impacts might be, but we do expect that more and more lakes will join that group of over 100 milligrams per liter or over 230 even. So by 2050, if the current trends continue, we'd expect to see that 14 of those would actually exceed that 230 milligrams per liter, which means that aquatic life like fish and other organisms can't survive in that concentration. But at much lower levels, we do see impacts sometimes for water quality, human health, and for community health. So we see ecological impacts in lakes at much lower concentrations.
Talk a little bit about what those are.
Well, one of the main things that can happen is we might see changes in community composition and function. So when I say community, in talking about a lake, I'm talking about zooplankton and phytoplankton. So those are like the teeny tiny plants and animals that live in lakes. And there have been studies that have shown in the lab, for example, that certain levels of salt are toxic to particular organisms. And those tend to be those high levels, like the ones that are represented by that aquatic life criterion. But at much lower levels, sometimes you see shifts in the, let's say, the competitive advantage of different organisms. And so you could see changes in the composition of that community. And one thing that's of particular concern is that some of the most salt-tolerant species tend to be the cyanobacteria or blue-green algae. You may have spoken about them on this show before. Mm-hmm. And they are, some of them are bloom-forming or toxin-forming species that they create those blooms in the lakes, and they're toxic to humans, animals, including pets. So in terms of water quality, that's an issue that we really care about a lot.
So what are the actual factors in determining if a lake or a pond is going to see these really increased salt levels? I mean, does it have to do with human development?
Yeah. In general, there are a few main causes of increases in salinization in lakes. One that's been studied a lot recently in individual lakes is road salt, as you mentioned earlier. I'll mention briefly, there's also a fair amount of agricultural runoff, industry input in some places. But in our study, we wanted to look at patterns over widespread areas of the country, and road salting is something that happens over a lot of area. So in our study, we found that when we looked at a lot of characteristics of our lakes, including just physical characteristics like size, the climate, landscape, for lakes in those snowy winter areas, really road density or the impervious surface around the lake was the main risk factor for salinization. And this surprised us, actually. As little as 1% of impervious surface puts a lake at risk for salinization.
So you mean paved roads or also, you know, paved driveways and parking
exactly,
lots?
Exactly. So when I say impervious surface, I mean roads, highways, all that, but also parking lots, driveways, and even house roofs, which obviously you're not going to be salting the roof, but it's a good measure of urbanization around a lake, which, you know, you'd think, sure, if a lake has, say, you know, 10, 20, 30% of the area around it is urbanized, you might expect that you'd be getting a lot of runoff from those surfaces. But that 1% number was really interesting to us because it means that even lakes that seem fairly minimally developed are potentially at risk if there is development in that sort of buffer zone around the lake.
Your study looked at 371 lakes, as we said, and this is from Maine all the way through the Great Lakes up into Canada.
I
understand you didn't have Quebec and the Maritimes, but you did have Ontario.
Yeah.
For Vermont and New Hampshire, our local area here, where do we fall within this level of salty lakes and ponds?
That's a good question. And, you know, it's interesting, when we were looking for data from the Northeast, we found that there aren't a huge number of lakes in Vermont and New Hampshire where data have been collected over the long term. But I'll give two examples. So one is Lake Champlain is seeing increasing salt concentrations since the 80s. The average is over that whole time is only about 11 milligrams per liter, but that is steadily increasing. And I know there have been some efforts in lake management to control salt inputs. And the second example is over in New Hampshire and actually is one of the lakes that inspired our study. So there's a lake called Muir Lake up near Hubbard Brook along Interstate 91. And when I-91 was constructed in that corridor in the late 60s, the researchers who were tracking the health of that lake actually noticed this real sudden increase in salt concentration, and year on year it was increasing more and more. And so that was one of the first places that tipped off researchers in this area that this can be a problem. And so there are current efforts there to redirect runoff and try to get those salt concentrations decreasing again. Of course, I'll mention one other thing. Once salt is put out there year on year, a lot of it does flow with runoff into the water bodies, but a lot is also stored in soil. So even if we stopped tomorrow, you know, adding salt to that system, it would keep sort of rinsing out of the soil over some number of years to come before you'd start to really see a decrease in the lake concentration.
But I what you're saying is that we would see a decrease over time if we reduced or stopped our salting. But you know, what's the balance? I know this isn't your decision to make, or you don't have to know the answer, but how do we balance safety for humans who are on the roads with a healthy ecology of a lake as we look at what your study found?
It's a great question. You know, when we were working on getting this paper ready for publication in this winter, I would be at my desk at work working on writing, and then I'd get in my car to drive home, and if it was 5 p.m. and a storm had come in, I'd say, oh my goodness, I hope they've salted the roads in front of me. So I think it's, you know, it's pertinent for all of us. Obviously, municipalities and counties can work to reduce their salt application or combine salt with gravel in cases where that's possible. It also saves money to do that, so it's in everyone's best interest. But I think that there are a couple of other things that we could all be more aware of that might not impact our safety, say. One is that the area around a lake that we found to be important was at least 500 meters. And so, you know, not all states manage the buffer zone around a lake to 500 meters. So if that could happen in more places, that would be wonderful, because then we'd be looking at controlling salt input in an area that's more relevant for the ecosystem. And then the second piece is that
make it quick.
In some places, up to 50% of salt applied is actually done by private landowners and businesses. So we can all try to reduce our application in driveways, walkways. Think of it more as a little sprinkle rather than just sort of dumping shovelfuls out there.
Well, that's a good knowledge base for us to have, and to have this understanding of how salinated our waterways are. Flora Krivec-Tetley is a PhD student in biology at Dartmouth College, and she's been telling us about the findings the Global Lake Ecological Observatory Network has reported about how road salt is affecting lakes and ponds. Flora, thanks.
Thank you so much.